Alliance Physical Therapy Partners and Agile Virtual Physical Therapy proudly present Agile and Me, a physical therapy leadership podcast devised to help emerging and experienced therapy leaders learn more about various topics relevant to outpatient therapy services.
Welcome back to Agile and Me, a PT leadership podcast series. I am excited to welcome back Mark Setlock, who is our Director of Payer Relations for Alliance Physical Therapy. So welcome back, Mark.
Thank you, Richard. It's great to be back.
So we get to talk about all things payer contracts again. So exciting. This episode, what I'd like to do is talk in more detail about the contracts. As therapists, we never got any training on contracts in school. I didn't get much training on anything apart from manual therapy and exercise-based care, to be honest. But I'm sure as local leaders or private practice owners, I think your insight into contracting will be very valuable. For those that perhaps didn't listen to the first episode, would you like to just remind the listeners about your background briefly and before we dive into perhaps the topic of contracts?
Sure. So a long time ago, I started in the contracting world under a academic medical center. And shortly after having a job there, I joined a physical therapy provider that became a national provider. And for the last 15 or so years, I've been doing managed care contracting negotiations for mostly PT and physician groups. So,
well, you've weathered it well, Mark. So congratulations. I think I'd probably be ready to run for the hills if it was me doing payer contracting. So congratulations. So last episode, we talked about payer contracts, what contract is, in and out of network, the pros and cons associated with it. This episode, I'd really like to kind of dive into payer contracts because what I've seen is a lot of providers have contracts, but one, they probably don't have a copy. If they do, they probably can't find it. And they honestly probably have limited understanding of what's in the contract and what they're supposed to be doing and the parameters of it. And as we'll find out, I'm sure some of the perhaps sting in the tails, which are hidden within them. So I think it's valuable to talk in a little bit more detail about payer contracts. So to kick off, what are the key components and terms that are embedded in payer contracts?
Sure. So the good news is that a lot of the contracts are structured similarly based on, I guess, contract law. So a lot of the same clauses are in all the contracts and the standard contract. And they're generally in the same place in the contracts and they're broken up into articles and blah, blah, blah. But the key clauses that I look for focus around like rates. So usually on a contract, there is an exhibit A, and that's usually your rates. I go there first to make sure that the contract is worth reading anyway, that if they're not going to pay me decent rates right off the bat, I can assume that the contract is probably going to be very restrictive. So after the rates, the second key thing I look at is for the initial term. So the initial term dictates that when you sign that contract, how long are you abiding by those rules until you can amend the contract into more favorable terms for yourself? So generally speaking, the initial term is generally either 1 year to 5 years. And a lot of them fall on that third year, on a three-year initial term. So just in general terms, that means that if you sign your contract on day one, that you have to abide by that contract for 3 years until you can even hope to get better rates or get it amended or get any language changes or anything like that. So rates first, initial term second. Second or third thing I look at is the termination clause. So that's the clause that's going to tell you how easy is it to get out of this contract if that contract happens to go sideways and you decide that this isn't what you wanted to. Generally speaking, the termination clauses are generally about 180 days, but in an ideal case, you want it to be as low as possible. And generally, I try to negotiate that to 90 days or less. I feel that that time frame, that window, would give you enough insight into the referrals that you're receiving and how well the payer plays with you in paying the claims properly. In speaking about paying claims properly, the next item I look at is the timely filing clause. So that tells you, once you send a clean claim, meaning there are no adjustments that need to be made to that clean claim or that claim, that how fast do they pay for that claim and get you reimbursed back. So a lot of states have 45 days as the state rule, but you try to get that as quickly as possible. And generally, you would like it to be within 14 days, which is generally what Medicare pays. But the payers will often push that date, the date back. After the timely filing, so the timely filing is the amount of time that they require you to get a claim into them after that date of service has been completed. So a lot of times they will restrict that to 90 days or to 120 days. And whereas if it's a secondary claim, or there's a problem with the insurance or the getting the proper documentation in place, you might need to push that back. A lot of times it has to do with credentialing. So they might backdate your claims for you, meaning that if you treat somebody as out of network, but you're in the process of signing a contract, that they will go back to that date of service and pay it as if it were in network when you treat it. So that's going to push your time back. And so the timely filing is very important, because as you're holding those claims, you want to make sure you have as much time possible to get that claim in so that they accept it as an in-network claim and pay it appropriately. So generally speaking, I look to get at least 120 to 180 days for a timely filing clause, so that I know that credentialing can take up to 6 months to get done. And so we want to make sure that we have as much time as possible to submit that claim for payment. The next thing I look at is timely payment of those clean claims. So generally speaking, states have mandated timely filing regulations that payers have to follow for a clean claim. And generally speaking, that's usually between 45 and 60 days. Now, I always look to try to get that down closer to what Medicare generally pays, and that's 14 days. So anytime between 14 days and 45 days, you're going to be getting payment faster. And so that's why I look at the timely payment of clean claims. And then just two other ones that I key in on. I check to see what the arbitration process is. So if you're in the middle of this contract that you thought was going to be an excellent contract, and for whatever reason, you're finding that it's not what you signed up for, then generally speaking, you work in good faith to fix whatever issue you happen to find. But if you can't resolve it on your own between you and the payer, then you want to be sure that there's some kind of an arbitration process to look at, so that you can go to a third party. They can hear both sides, and then they can decide if who is right, who is wrong, who needs to change, and that sort of thing. And then the final thing I look at is the future amendments. I want to make sure that the payer can't unilaterally change the contract without us having some kind of an opt-out mechanism, so that if we don't agree with it, if it's going to hurt our business, then we want to be able to say, okay, we're not going to accept that product, we're not going to accept a different rate or something like that. So those are the key items I look for in a contract.
Most orthotic manufacturers take a one-shape-fits-all approach to solving lower body pain symptoms. They focus on arch support for temporary pain relief, which can lead to inefficiencies and injuries. BioCorrect does things differently. With 25 years of experience, BioCorrect knows that everyone has unique needs. BioCorrect is a fully customizable foot orthotic system engineered to address and treat the biomechanical imbalances of your entire body. BioCorrect, more than just an insert. To learn more, visit us at biocorrect.com.
There is an absolutely huge amount to unpack here, isn't there? So that's quite a few things to look at. I think before I was educated, I think, well, it was just negotiate a rate and there isn't really much else. But whilst it's the first and foremost, it's certainly in itself not necessarily the key part in some respects. One can perhaps be prepared for a slightly lower rate than perhaps one would normally accept, as long as all the other things are perhaps good, and vice versa. So it's interesting that there are so many different components to look at. First one I think I would like to question or ask about is this idea of term. Now, if I understand correctly, it may be, let's say, a three-year term or a five-year term, but most of them, I believe, are evergreen in regards to they just auto-renew, yes?
So yes.
Unless you actively approach the payer, it's just going to renew exactly the same terms, correct?
Correct. But that happened, that evergreen clause kicks in after the initial term. So it will set aside either a year or 3 years or 5 years where you can't do anything. You can't terminate. You can't change any clauses or anything like that. So it is true that payers like them to be evergreen so that we forget about them and we don't force ourselves to renegotiate or bring issues to the table or consider not getting out of the contract. So those are two different things, and generally they're in the same clause, but they are two distinct time periods that you need to be aware of.
You bring up a really good point about this concept of, well, once it's signed and put in the cabinet, you just forget about it. And that's, I believe, part of the reason why our rates are so bad at certain times is because we haven't gone in, dusted it off, and actually challenged them. Sometimes it's just the fact that we just forget about it. Like most things, a bit like your Netflix or Amazon membership, it comes out of the bank and you just forget about it. And I'm sure some of these lower rates, even if people just dusted them off, could probably get some improvements, yes?
Yes, I agree. Yep.
Now, we talked about this concept, let's say, for instance, a three-year term, but there's a termination clause. Is it normal to have termination clause capabilities within that initial three-year term, or is it only for cause that you're able to implement that termination clause? Sorry, there's a lot of confusion, cause and clause. But so, for instance, if you're going to sign an agreement contract, it's a three-year term. Is it really 3 years where you can just give 90, 100 day out at any point, or are you literally stuck for 3 years unless there is good reason?
Yeah, so you bring up a great point that you have termination with cause and you have termination without cause. So the termination with cause would be that one party or the other has breached the contract in some way. They haven't upheld their end of the agreement. And generally speaking, then that gives you a time to remedy that. And generally, that's like a 60-day time period where you're working in good faith. And that's where that arbitration clause kicks in then to make sure that somebody in a third party, a group of decision makers that are not connected to either company, would be making a decision based on the evidence that you each bring up in an arbitration meeting. However, so during that initial term of 1, 3, or 5 years, then you could potentially terminate with cause, and that would not be part of the waiting period. However, if you're trying to terminate without cause, that you just want to get out because it's not working for you, generally you need to wait until that initial term has ended before you can implement that. You can ask to terminate the agreement based on however long it takes to terminate.
So really what that means to me is you better make damn sure that you really want to get in bed with this payer and truly become a in-network provider, because you could be stuck in a really bad marriage for a period of time without actually to, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why contracts are never written easily and in layman's terms. They're very, very distinct, and you really have to read through them to make sure that something provided in one clause isn't taken away in a couple clauses down. So it's very important to make sure that you're looking at the contracts and any references that they're making to exhibits and attachments that are to that contract. You want to make sure that you're following through to see that what does that exactly mean based on this clause.
And then even after the contract ends, are there any constraints, limitations, any requirements usually embedded within the contracts that are maintained or continue after the contract has ended? Or is it literally you're done, no responsibilities, no commitments, and off you go again?
Yeah, so generally speaking, you have to give a certain period of time notice. And again, I try to get that down to about 90 days. But during that 90 days that you're unwinding and getting out of that agreement, that participation, you're required to continue to see your patients if they haven't moved on to someone else. And if you haven't found a suitable person to take over, that you still need to see the patients and continue to treat them based on the regulations and the clauses in the contract.
Moving on, what I've been told is very often, and see, is very often payers will follow to a certain extent, or many payers will follow to a certain extent, Medicare with regards to their requirements. What I believe I'm seeing is they follow Medicare with lower rates, and an increasing burden, administrative burden. Is that fair and reasonable to say?
Yes, and I think that's very accurate to say. And I know that there's a school of thought out there that you can't just say you follow Medicare rates or Medicare rules without actually following all of Medicare's rules. So picking and choosing which rules you want to follow under Medicare is not appropriate, and there is a body of evidence that states that you should not be held to those standards unless they're accepting everything from Medicare. So,
I know we can't talk about individual rights because contractually we're not allowed to, but at a very high level, when I came across 20 years ago, Medicare was, I perceived, to be one of the lower payers. But nowadays, I believe that it's probably one of the better payers. And I hate to say it, probably one of the ones with the least administrative burden, which I never thought I would say in my entire career. So there's definitely been a change in rates over time, and not in a positive way, unfortunately. And there's changes in administrative burden, yes?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So a lot of times when I'm looking at contracts, I'm using Medicare as a benchmark. So to know if I'm getting a fair rate from a payer, what I try to do is quantify what my clinic's cost to provide care is, and then seeing what the fee schedule will provide based on the codes that I'm billing. And if I'm over my cost, then I'm like, okay, how much bigger can I get that operating margin? The other thing I would do is I compare it to other payers that have similar products and compare the two and see how close they are to those. And then, like I said, I benchmark to Medicare because Medicare is generally higher than the cost to treat. And so if you can bump that to at least 100% of Medicare or at 105% or even 140%, then you're that much better off.
Yeah, What I think everyone should do is really what you're saying is calculate the actual true cost of a visit. And if you're not sure as a private practice owner, I think what you do is you just go to a publicly traded entity like USPT, for instance, or ATI, and look through their quarterly reports, and you can work out approximately what their cost is, which would probably be actually cheaper probably than what an independent practitioner's cost is. So looking at reports, I would say a cost per visit is anywhere between probably $85 and $90 a visit. And whilst not pointing fingers, there are definitely reimbursement rates in contract rates that are south of that, correct?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's many of them out there.
I think the last thing about the contracts, the specific key components that I find interesting, this concept of timely filing. I find it amusing, the fact that credentialing can take well in excess of 120 days now. well in excess by many payers. And then if they've got a clause in there that says you have to present the file within 120 days, they're essentially getting free care potentially, yes?
Yeah, yeah, that's certainly how that would work out, because you're using the same time frame, the same dates from date of service to when you're filing the claim. So yeah, that's certainly not a good thing for the provider.
So if one is wanting to set up a practice or add another clinic, because not only individual providers having to be credentialed, but clinics as well. If you are setting up a private practice, then that's probably really important. Well, it is really important to look at when you're looking at payer contracts, because otherwise you could be providing significant amounts of care for free. At very best, it will be a cash flow concern. At worst, you'd have to essentially write off potentially a significant number of visits, yes?
Yes, exactly right. And you can't balance bill the patient those visits. So you're stuck. Yeah.
So I think the question is, and I think we've kind of touched on it away, but how do I know if I'm getting a reimbursement rate that's fair and reasonable? So I think it really goes back to that kind of Medicare piece as well. But having said that, I certainly don't want to perhaps listeners to feel that Medicare is a gold standard. It's probably a pewter at best standard, and I believe that we've kind of sunk so low where if we get a mediocre reimbursement rate, which is probably Medicare, we think that's a win. But anyway, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but how do I know if I'm getting a reimbursement rate that's fair and reasonable without obviously talking numbers?
Right. So I think that it's very important to consider everything when you're looking at the costs that your company is needing to bear. So you do have your cost of care, but you also should be looking at your credentialing costs and how easy is it to get credentialed or not easy to get credentialed. How many submissions do you have to submit to get all the data in? What's the authorization process, the verification process? How difficult is it to get that claim to them? And I think you need to consider all of those costs when you're looking at your rate and looking at other payers that may pay similar rates, but don't require all that extra administrative burden. And so certainly if one is causing you an additional burden, then they should be paying you additionally as well.
Yeah, it reminds me of perhaps certain payers. I have to be careful with regards to whom and not give any indication, but there's definitely a trade-off, isn't there? I can think of two comparable payers, and one pays at a higher rate, but you have to wait a long time, and one pays at a lower rate, but they pay very quickly. So do you have both? Do you accept the longer term? Because time is money.
Right.
So in that respect, they probably know that if they pay quickly, they can get away with a lower rate for the providers.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yep, they figured it out.
That's right, yeah.
At Alliance, we believe that partnership means creating something greater than the sum of its parts. Our focus is finding physical therapy practices with a strong culture and thriving community, and providing them with additional tools, resources, and expertise to take their practice to the next level. To learn more about joining our nationwide community of outpatient physical therapy practices, visit our website at alliancepTP.com.
Clinicians, we got to figure it out, haven't we? How else might know? We talk about Medicare and a percentage of Medicare. Is that actually quite a common way payers will set their rates?
A lot of times they will go with 100% of Medicare and keep that benchmark for themselves, depending on your leverage. And again, contract negotiations depends on who has the best leverage at that time. So if you're a major player in your market, then you're usually able to get perhaps slightly above Medicare, 101%, 105%. If they really need you in network, then you might be able to see 130% or 140%. But it's something that I'm always shooting for the stars. And if I'm able to get 140%, then certainly I'm going to ask it. But we'll have a realistic expectation of being closer to that 100%, maybe 105 or 110%. One way that you can get to that larger percents is also to build in escalators into the contract so that each year you have a cost of living adjustment added so that you don't get down 3 or 5 years into your contract and you're still at those rate, the initial rates that you agreed to. So that's one thing you can negotiate. And again, it's leverage, that if you have some leverage and they're willing to put it in the contract, you can build in some escalators in there to help make sure that you're staying at least close to the rate of inflation.
Interesting point. I was doing a little bit of research today about essentially the impact of inflation on costs. And I worked out that if there was a theoretical $75 reimbursement per visit and it was set up in 2013, you would have to be reimbursed at a rate of $99 today just for parity, the impact of inflation. And when people think, well, it's a flat reimbursement rate, it's not going up. Well, by not going up, it's going down.
Exactly.
And I think people forget about that. And perhaps only in the last couple of years, when inflation rates have gone up, that's probably been on the radar more. But if your rate is flat and you have no escalator, your reimbursement rate is going down. Yes.
Yes, I agree. That is exactly right. And that's the realness that we deal with in business.
So. Yeah. And the other point that I think is important is this concept of being above Medicare rate and thinking that 140% of Medicare rate is this real win. Well, the reality is if I understand correctly, based off conversations I had with other leaders, Medicare rate has gone down by 30% in the last 10 years. So I don't know if that's relative or real, but it's gone down with multiple procedure code discount, the PTA 15% reduction, the sequestration, et cetera, et cetera. It's gone down. Mm-hmm. So when we say, well, we're negotiating rate above Medicare, it's not really a huge win, is it? It's the fact that we're just trying to claw to a certain extent back to parity, yes?
Well, you're exactly right, because you have to remember that if the rates did drop 30%, it's taken 140% of that 30% discount as well. So you need to try to get back up to that 100% that you initially agreed to. So yeah, the numbers, you can play tricks with those numbers. So
as we might as well depress ourselves a little bit more. So obviously rate is a factor, but with most contracts, there's the fine print, and I'm sure these contracts have some fine print, and I haven't read enough to know if they do it in font size 6 or not, but I'm sure there is definitely some language that is tucked away, shall we say. What is commonly placed into payer contracts that you would say could trip up providers?
So I think that underscores that even though it's not the funnest thing to do, read through contracts, it's very important to do for your business. And so some of the lesser of language that they put in there, stating that it's you'll be paid the lesser of gross charges or 60% of Medicare or $65. You have to be sure what the lesser amount is, because that's going to be your reimbursement rate. So lesser of language is very important to get out of there if you can. Unit limits, sometimes they'll tell you $65, but you can only charge one unit and they cap it off. So, or they'll say unlimited units, but it's capped at $70. So you might think, okay, well, I can continue to bill as I normally do and get X number of dollars, but in reality, you're going to be limited to that cap rate that they put on there. Sometimes they'll tie the termination to like an end of a renewal period. So I've run into some where you have to give 180 days prior notice to the end of the current period. And so it ends on 12/31, which means on March 31st of that same year, you would need to put that notification in or wait until the following end of the year of the next calendar year to actually be able to get out of that contract. So you have to read these things very closely. And so they're always putting new stuff in there, but it's crucial to read through them. Now, some of them, they don't put these kinds of things in, but there are some out there that do. So you have to be careful.
I'd love to ask which ones do these tricks, but I mustn't, I suppose. And I'm sure we get into trouble if we name names, but it's pretty sad indictment, isn't it? That major payers, I assume they're major payers, mm-hmm. are putting things into it. And let's give them the benefit of the doubt, I suppose. I don't normally give them the benefit. And let's just say that it's an oversight, or it's just they made a mistake. But anyway, Anyway. We talk about rate, and we also talked about rate a little bit in the prior podcast, but let's revisit it. And particularly against a backdrop of significant labor inflation generally. For instance, I calculated that the CPI in the last 3 years have caused facility costs to go up on average about 13%. Wage inflation's been higher than that for many healthcare providers. So with the increasing costs, we've got to be able to increase our revenue. Otherwise, we're going to have problems. And we're already seeing that with a lot of private practices just literally closing the door. I've never seen it before until recently where private practices are just giving up. There's obviously others that are successful, but definitely there's a portion that are just either being acquired or giving up. So ultimately, with increasing expense, we've got to get a higher reimbursement rate. And that's either, I assume, going out to network or offering self-pay, or it's trying to negotiate better rates in network. So can we push back on reimbursement rate if we're in network? And two, what are perhaps some of the tactics that perhaps you can use?
Sure. So I would say, yes, you should always push back on the contracts. That if you can better the contract in your favor, that's certainly what you should try to do. As far as some strategies, what I like to implement would be getting as much data as I can to, quote unquote, justify why I feel that we deserve higher rates, that we have great outcomes. Our length of stay is typically shorter than perhaps an industry standard. I would also consider carving out certain services that we know are popular services for us. And so we might be able to get those services at a higher rate. The same with codes, that if there are certain codes that we know we will bill at higher frequency than other codes, and we're able to carve them at a different rate overall as our utilization is such that those codes would be more frequent. We would get higher reimbursement than just a flat rate given to us on the contract. So those are kind of things that I would do, and including building relationships with the payers. Because I think that if you actually make a relationship with someone, that your chances are a little bit better for them to humanize you and help you get what you need, or at least meet you halfway somewhere to help. So I always stay civil in any negotiations I do, but I also try to find opportunities to reach out to them and just get my name in their minds and let them realize who Alliance is or whatever PT company. And the other thing is that by pushing back on the contracts, you're kind of building that persona that, okay, well, if you monkey with my claims, I'm not going to be happy with that either. And I'll push back on that. And if you don't give me the authorizations promptly, I'm going to push back on that. So I think that setting that expectation up front in your contract negotiations allows you to have a little bit easier journey down the road as you're submitting claims and showing them that you're not going to put up with them making a lot of adjustments off your claims or whatever. So
I think the last thing perhaps I'm interested in knowing your perspective on is related to the impact of labor shortages on payer contracts or being in networks. So we are not graduating a sufficient number of therapists, physical therapists, to meet demand. And this will continue based off the literature to at least 2030. So there is a structural labor issue, and it's getting worse. To the point, if I'm correct, based off the literature, it will result in approximately a 20% deficit of therapists by 2030 compared to the demand for therapy. So we've got a supply and demand mismatch. We've got more people essentially on a national basis that could benefit and require therapy compared to the number of providers. And then we've got reimbursement challenges. Do you think that the shortage of therapists is likely to have any impact on payer contracting in any way?
I think because the industry is going through that, I don't think it's going to have as big an effect, or a positive effect, I should say, from our perspective with the payers. I think that as a society, our patients are becoming okay with waiting lists and not being able to be seen immediately. So with this shortage, what that means is our costs are going to skyrocket trying to get the best and brightest therapists to join our provider group. And I don't think the payer really worries about that. I think they know that we're fighting over each other to get these providers in, and they can continue to keep paying because they're not going to hear from the members. I have no access, because they know that, okay, well, there's a wait list everywhere because there is a shortage. So I think that hurts the PT industry, because the payer can just point at that and say, well, it's not us. The access point issue that you're having is because they can't find enough providers. So I kind of think from a contract perspective, that's not going to help us. And I think it just gives the payers one more reason to say, well, it's not us, it's them. They can't find people. So
thank you. Well, always great to chat with you, Mark. Lots of great information today to unpack and for listeners to perhaps take with them when they're looking at contracts going forward. So thank you so much for your insight and wisdom, and look forward to chatting with you again in part 3 of the installment in payer negotiating contracts. So thank you.
That sounds good, Richard. Thank you so much.
This podcast was brought to you by Alliance Physical Therapy Partners. Want more expertise and information? Visit our website at alliancepTP.com and follow us on social media. You can find links below in the description. As always, thank you for listening.